Jerry Weber was one of Oklahoma's most beloved broadcasters. He was a reporter, sportscaster, news anchor, and storyteller. In 1969, he joined KJRH Channel 2 in Tulsa, Oklahoma as a reporter, and in 1971 was named sports director. His love for news prompted his move to news anchor in 1986. Wayne McCombs interviewed Jerry October 12, 1998, just 2 months before Jerry died December 19, 1998. Jerry was 62 when he lost his battle with cancer. You will hear Jerry talk about the University of Tulsa basketball program, Coach Nolan Richardson, the 1981 NIT championship, Barry Switzer at Oklahoma football, and other topics. Listen to Wayne McCombs as he interviews Jerry Weber for Voices of Sports Legends on the oral history website, voicesofoklahoma.com.
Jerry, you grew up in Coss City, Oklahoma, up in Osage County. Tell me about your boyhood and how you got involved in sports.
Well, radio was a big thing when I was growing up. St. Louis Cardinals, the only broadcast you could get in the state of Oklahoma when I was growing up, as far as Major League Baseball. My dad and I'd get the milking done, and at night, that was our recreation because, listening to the Cardinals. He was a great Cardinal fan. Now, we're talking about the days of Musial and Slaughter and Shane Dinks and Marty Marion and Harry the Cat Brackeen and some of those people that you've got to be my age even to remember now or to be a great baseball fan. But that really got me hooked on baseball, and I never deviated from that team, I think, because Cardinals were a good organization then. Mm-hmm. They and the Dodgers and the Yankees sort of set the standard. And they each had a particular style. They each had farm systems, that developed these fine players. And then there was an aura around Stan Musial that I liked, because mm-hmm. he was always known as a gentleman, as well as one of the great hitters that ever played the game. So that's where I got hooked.
Did you play sports in high school?
Played sports in high school. Went to a tiny high school. Basketball was my best sport. Played baseball, ran track. I didn't have enough people to play football. There were only 12 people in my senior class, six of those were boys. So, a typical small-town Oklahoma.
Yeah. How did you get to go to college?
A basketball scholarship, as a matter of fact.
Now, weren't you a big fan of Oklahoma A&M and Ibis teams?
I was. Didn't get a chance to go to school there. And one of the again, you go back to radio, is one of the reasons I was such a big fan. They used to do a delayed broadcast of every OSU game. Now, Oklahoma A&M mm-hmm. back then.
Yes.
When they were in the Missouri Valley Conference, at 10:30 at night on KBOO radio, a man by the name of John Henry
yes.
would come on the air and would do the game, mm-hmm. And Dad and I would listen to that. Again, there was a tie. I was born in Burbank, not far from Coss City. And Burbank's another one of those towns of 200 people,
Yes.
There was a young fella named Norman Pilgrim who had grown up in Burbank and had played point guard at OSU. So there was that tie. And
yes.
So we all emulated him. We all wanted mm-hmm. to be like him. And of course, you got to remember, back then, Oklahoma A&M and University of Kansas were the scourge of the Midlands. Mr. Iba, I'll never forget the first time I ever got to see a live game in Gallagher Hall. A man took a bunch of us kids down there, and they were playing Kansas. And that's when a guy by the name of Clyde LaVellet
yes.
was the big post guy for Kansas, and they had a great team. And I have never in my life, had never before, been in an atmosphere like that, where you would open your mouth and scream and couldn't hear yourself, in mm-hmm. Gallagher Hall. But that's what I grew up with. And radio had so much to do with it, and then on Saturday afternoons, you listen to the Sooners play football, because they had that same kind of success when I was growing up with Bud Wilkinson coaching there.
Yeah.
And they had those great winning streaks. So you used your imagination before television, you know, certainly before television was established at all. And I still miss those days, because there's nothing like when there is a good announcer at the microphone, nothing like using your imagination in sports.
Mm-hmm. When you, where'd you go to college?
Oklahoma City University.
What'd you major in?
English.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What made you want to get into to English? You wanted to, did you want to teach school?
No, I wanted to write. The other thing is, it's the best thing I did, oddly enough, you know, for a country kid. I was good at English because I loved to read.
Yes.
I had learned to read when I was tiny. Reading always fascinated me. Books fascinated me. Newspapers fascinated me. And so it was the easiest thing for me, which sounds odd, but it was.
Mm-hmm. After you graduated from Oklahoma City, how did you get started into broadcasting?
Because I had a wife who loved me and knew that I needed to be doing something that, you know, that was right for me. I grew up working in the oil fields and working on a ranch, you know.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that. It's hard work. I could make a good living at it. Not something that you want to do all of your life.
Mm-hmm.
It's cold in the winter out there and it's hot in the summer. And she was willing to sacrifice. I took a huge pay cut for my first radio job in Claremore, Oklahoma. You know,
KWPR and KWPR top of the hotel.
Top of the hotel. They'd just gone on the air, and they gave me an opportunity. And
we had to walk out on the roof of the building to get to the announce booth.
Yes,
didn't
you did. And but that, but it was a chance. And I was there only a month or so, and they had an interlocking ownership at that time with KVIN in Bonita, which was older and more established.
Yes.
They sent me up there and I stayed 10 months.
Now, this is 1959, is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's in that area. Greatest thing that ever happened to me. I'd get up in the morning, I'd be the old saddle shiner. Play country and western music, open the station at 5 o'clock in the morning, and give stock market reports, that kind of thing. Work that
you're
shift.
Talking stock market, you're talking animal.
No, we're talking
you're
about
not talking canter, Dow Jones.
Canters and cutters and gilts and
Sal Bellies,
that's what we're talking
that's
about.
That's right.
And then about 9 o'clock, I'd go home. My wife would fix breakfast. I'd bathe and shave. I'd go out and sell advertising. Come back about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, about the time school was out, change my voice and do a rock and roll show, you know.
What was your name then?
Well, I don't even remember, you know, what my name was. I just, the most important thing was to change my voice where you didn't recognize the old saddle shiner. And then, if there was a high school football or basketball game that night, this is a daytime only station.
Yes.
I'd take a tape recorder out and record it, and we'd play it back on the weekend.
That's right.
Then I would come back, I'd sweep out. The only thing I didn't get involved with was engineering. And so I got the greatest education in broadcasting in about 10 months, that you practical education that you can get. And from there went back to my wife's hometown of Ponca City and stayed there until I came here.
So your wife was from the big city of Ponca City.
Big city of Ponca City. And I mean that. I mean, there were three movie theaters there. You know?
Okay, you're in Ponca City. We're about, what, 66, 67?
Yeah.
In there. And how did you learn of the job opening at then KVOO Television in Tulsa?
Well, Harold Stewart, the owner of KVOO at the time, they were up there attempting to get a franchise for cable, you know.
Early
cable television. And they had heard me and they had offered me a job and I'd turned it down because by then I was managing the station, working on a percentage, had a good job, lifetime job. They were owned by the newspaper.
Yeah. Just WBBZ?
WBBZ.
Uh-huh.
Great ownership, you know, and at home, not far from where I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And I turned them down a couple of times before I finally finally thought, well, you know, this new television thing, if I'm going to do it, I can't wait much longer, age-wise. And so I finally accepted it.
So you came to KVOO Television in 1969.
Right, March 3rd.
You were hired to do sports.
Right.
But what happened? You were the anchor of the news.
Right. Yeah, just an accident. The young man who was doing that, his wife had to be taken to the hospital, was about to miscarry.
Mm-hmm.
And they had told me, I'd never been on camera in my life, said, Jerry, you know, we'll teach you how to relate to a camera for a couple of weeks before you go on the air. First day I get here, his wife begins to miscarry or threaten to. And they got nobody to put on the air. We didn't have staffs the size you have now. And so for about 2 weeks, I wind up anchoring the 6 and 10 news.
Well, in those days, in the television reporters area, you did the radio news also.
Yeah.
There was a microphone, you know,
which I was accustomed to doing.
Yeah, the guys in the booth upstairs at KBO Radio would buzz you, hey, you're ready to go on the air, and you would do the news actually from the television reporters' desk. Those were the days with Alan Lambert as Captain Allen and Lynn,
great times.
Lynn Morton in sports.
Oh, great times.
A terrific
Ron
staff.
Franklin was here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you do news for a while, and then how do you get back into sports?
I do news. I anchor news. He comes back. His wife does all right. He comes back. They like what I did. They give me the 6. He does the 10. Pretty soon, he takes off for another job in another state. And so I anchored the news until Jack Morris came over from Channel 8.
That's right. That was big news.
Oh, that was big news because he was a famous anchor and had been there for years.
He'd been on since they signed on. He was at KTUL Radio.
Yeah.
And was their newsman there for years, switched to television.
Right.
And when Channel 2, KBOO, brought Jack Morris over here in 1970, that was...
Major news.
Giant news.
And so what happened was I reported for him then until Scripps Howard bought this station in 70, and then I finally got to do what I was hired for, which was do sports.
Well, Mr. Stewart sold KBOO Television because he thought he would get the Tulsa Cable franchise rights and thought there would be conflict of interest, so he sold it to Scripps Howard.
And there was also a problem of a lot of stations at that time who owned more than one entity, like radio and television, felt they better divest, you know, because the FCC was doing strange things.
It's a little different today.
Yeah, really.
But back then,
just the opposite now.
Yeah, where it was so tight, and now it's almost there's almost no control.
Yeah.
Well, you get into sports in 1970, and about that time, the sports era is about to change. The days of Mickey Mantle and Willie Mays and Stan Musial and Johnny Unitas, Jim Brown, those days are about over, and we're getting into the new athlete, the Joe Namath, the Reggie Jackson, the Muhammad Ali people. And you begin your sports career at that time. Tell me about switching over to sports and what's the difference between reporting sports now and reporting sports back in 1970, although it's only been a little over 28 years or so. It's changed dramatically, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah, it's changed, which is the reason I was willing to change and go to news, because back then you didn't worry a lot about player unions and strikes, number one. You didn't worry a whole bunch about drugs and that sort of thing. I mean, maybe some guy went and drank too much, but you didn't worry about what you and I call hard drugs, which took a lot of the fun out of it. I just had the feeling that the players were not mercenary back then, that they were playing because they loved to play the game.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to remember, Wayne, that I am doing sports here at really a renaissance period of time. I mean, during that lengthy period of time, because you got Barry Switzer at Oklahoma.
Just began, right?
They're going to win national championships. Jimmy Johnson makes a stop off in Stillwater. And I remember one year, before Jimmy came, they had had some probation problems and had lost some scholarships. One year he won 7 or 8 ball games with more walk-ons than he had scholarship players.
Yes.
So you knew he could coach.
Yes.
Lou Holtz was spending some time at Arkansas during that period of time. You got John Cooper at TU, who's one of the classiest guys that ever coached, who has his team number one in the polls at Ohio State now.
Right.
And then, on top of all of this, you throw in a Nolan Richardson comes in, you know, and turns this town on its ear in 1981. But you can't forget, too, that during that period of time, Major League Soccer comes. Well, to this strange state, I must have been past 30 years old before I ever saw a soccer ball growing up in Oklahoma.
Right.
You know, and it comes here and does well and is still doing well. I mean, you know, it's still a great kid sport here. And then the Oklahoma Outlaws, we have a summer pro football league.
Mm-hmm.
So during my period of time, it was a renaissance.
Right.
And I loved every minute of it.
And we go from maybe the worst baseball facility for any type of baseball to maybe
Snaggletooth Ballpark.
To maybe the probably not more than one or two minor league ballparks that's better than Dover Park.
And kept playing through all of that period of time.
Right. Bill Rollins deserves a lot of
ought to be named president for what he did, you know, and just keeping things alive. He and Roy and the guitar pickers and this and that.
Well, you helped in 79, I believe, you helped organize a telethon to help save Tulsa baseball.
Right.
And that night,
Roy came down, did some picking.
Roy Clark, and you had all these people from Hee Haw, in the studio here at Channel 2, and you did an hour telethon, and you raised. It was your idea to raise money to save baseball,
and it worked. I mean, all of it together worked.
Yeah.
And now, as you say, we've got this great facility, but you know what? I still miss that old ballpark. Before it fell down.
Old Euler Park was probably, structure-wise, it was weak, but design-wise, it was probably one of the best-designed ballparks.
It was. Nooks and crannies in that place.
And you were 5 feet away from the on-deck batter. You could hear people in the press box yelling down at the players. It was a terrific ballpark. It's too bad that it had the accident in 76, or 77 had to be torn down.
I'm delighted with what we've got now.
Oh, it's a beautiful.
Because if they eventually want AAA baseball, that's going to happen because the support is here.
Right, Tell me about your, sports begins to change in the early 70s, in years past, the local reporter might go down and cover an OU game, might go over and cover an Oklahoma State basketball game, but that's it. Now, all of a sudden, Jerry, you're going down to Norman to cover all these terrific games. Tell me about the game of the century. November 1971, Oklahoma and Nebraska, probably the greatest college game played really in this century, was held. Tell me about that ball game where Nebraska won, but it was a little tainted by a no call on a penalty.
Yeah, but you know, probably Nebraska deserved to win. I read something just very recently, and I know you read it too, that Barry Switzer said that the one regret he had about that game is that he did not throw the ball to John Harrison more that day, because Harrison was open that day, and Mildren, you know, they had this connection, he and Mildren did anyway. The thing that I remember about that game was the huge dominating line of the University of Nebraska that has not changed in all these years since.
Yes.
Because I remember the last drive that they made. I don't think Nebraska on their last drive made more than 4 yards on any play, but they consistently whacked out 3 and 4 yards on every play.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't because OU was out of position. It wasn't because OU was tired. It wasn't because OU didn't have athletes. It was just that here was this mammoth line that did everything right and just whipped them off of the line of scrimmage, you know, and dominated the clock. And I remember I had a great photographer with me that day and took some footage, and I've looked at that footage many times since. OU gets the ball one last time, and he's got a shot of Mildren coming in and his back in, and his jersey's halfway torn off, you know.
Shoulder pads hanging off the wrong way.
He looks like exactly what he is. I mean, he has been a warrior, and he's going to be on the losing team, but they got this one last shot. And he turns, and I forget whether he handed the ball to Wiley. I can't remember who he handed the ball to. And he was just hit right in the mouth of the line of scrimmage. Mm-hmm. I mean, just drilled and dropped at the line of scrimmage. And this good photographer, smart enough, he wheels quickly to shoot his cutaway in the stands, and you can read in slow motion. You can read this woman's lips, this OU fan's lips, clearly saying, "Oh, no." And you can see the tears mm-hmm. coming down. And it said the whole thing. It summed it all up.
Yeah.
It was the game of the century. And I'm not going to tell you, and I love OU football, and I loved it then. I'm not going to tell you that the best team didn't win. Nebraska was a very good football team that day.
What was your relationship like with Barry Switzer in the good times and then toward the end and when he left?
I never had a bad relationship with him. I always admired him. I still think he's as good a football coach as I ever met.
Mm-hmm.
Because for the same reason that Nolan Richardson's a great basketball coach, kids related to him.
Mm-hmm.
Play their hearts out for him.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's what it's about.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you can say what you want, but when kids love you and will lay it all on the line for you and mm-hmm. believe you, that's really what college athletics is about. What I found out early on about Barry Switzer was if you're him sitting here and I'm the 15th of 40 interviews he's got to do today, you know, at the press day or whatever it is.
Yeah.
If I have prepared myself with intelligent questions, not just the usual, well, what's Jamel Holloway going to do or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But to challenge his intellect, he responded to that.
Mm-hmm.
He loved it.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And you would get great answers from him, and he would respect you for it, you know. And so I always worked very hard at that, at not being one of those guys who came in and did the obvious, but let him know that I had done a little extra study, whether it was an offensive tackle who got a key block or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always got great interviews with him.
Now, one thing a lot of people don't know, in the mid-70s, of course, you would do the 6 o'clock sports and come back for the 10 o'clock sports.
Mm-hmm.
But tell the people what you did in between the 6 o'clock sports and the 10 o'clock sports in the summertime.
Oh, I coached, you know.
Yeah, you coached Legion baseball.
I coached Legion baseball. Before that, I coached Mickey Mantle baseball. In the wintertime, Well, the system's still pretty much the same here in Tulsa Public Schools. I coached football and basketball mm-hmm. at what was then the junior high level, which would now be the middle school level. Most fun I ever had. But, yeah, Legion baseball, now that's a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's over my head because I ran into guys like Walt Rona, you know.
Yeah.
And Walt knew what he was doing, you know. Walt would beat me one. I don't know how many times he beat me 1-0 or 2-1, you know. Some little squeeze play or something, you know, would be out there. But it was great because, you know, you get kids at that age. They're out there because they want to be there.
Yes.
They feel like there's a scout watching or there's still a chance for a scholarship or they love the game, and that makes it easy.
Things change a little bit again in 1980 at the University of Tulsa. There's some broadcasting changes with their television coaches show playbacks and their radio situation over there. For years and years, they were with KVOO, and Len mm-hmm. Morton did all the ball games, and then some things changed there. And in 1980, the University of Tulsa hires you in Channel 2 to do both John Cooper's coaches show and the new coach they hired, some guy named Nolan Richardson. And then they ask you, "Hey, Jerry, would you want to do the games on the radio?"
Right.
Tell me about the beginning of your, I knew you already were enjoyed University of Tulsa sports, but now you were right in the thick of things with John Cooper and Nolan Richardson. Tell me about broadcasting those games on 1430 back in 1980.
Right.
With John Cooper and then with Nolan Richardson.
I guess as I look back at my career, it was the apex. And I mean that sincerely, because I liked them so much, still do, as human beings as well as coaches, and admire them. We had so much fun. I traveled with the teams.
Yes.
You know, and we did so many things, spent so many intimate hours together. And by that I mean after a game when you're winding down and maybe you have lost a game that maybe was taken away from you, you feel deep in your heart, and trying to help a coach wind down from that on a friendship basis, mm-hmm. you know. I loved it. And
You had two guys that were pretty even tempered.
Yeah. Yeah, you really did. But I know early on there were not a lot of black coaches in basketball around this part of the country when Nolan started. And I think Nolan had a right to believe early on that very close calls and on foreign courts sometimes mm-hmm. he didn't get the break.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I would talk about that deep into the night, you know. And to this day, I have so much respect for him. You know, I've not met a better coach.
Yeah.
For the very reason we were talking about a while ago, that he worked his kids harder than anybody I've ever seen. Yet they loved him because they knew he was doing what was best for them. You know, they understood mm-hmm. that. So they would accept it. And there were no respecter of persons. It didn't matter whether you're Paul Pressey, you know, or whether you're Rondi,
yeah.
You know, you do the same thing. And you do it hard. And but they knew that deep in their heart that he loved them.
Well, let's go back just to the contrast. Before Nolan came, Tulsa was playing, what, in front of 2,000 to 3,000 people
right.
in the convention center. They didn't have the end zone set in the convention center where they brought the stands setting right. in there. And they do that for Nolan's second game. They open the season in 80 with wins over Central State and Southwest Missouri State. Then they play the defending national champions.
Right.
This is December the 4th, 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And the atmosphere of that game, do you still remember calling that ball game?
Oh, it's electric.
That was the loudest. Electric. You know, for years, Tulsa hadn't had a very competitive team. And then all of a sudden, they're not only playing well, but they're beating the national champion at the University of Tulsa.
And Louisville was missing only one player from that national championship team
mm-hmm.
who had gone on to, I think he's playing for the Utah Jazz,
right.
the guard, you know. Had everybody else back.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember the incident that happened in that game, very late in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Wiley Brown, who's like a 6'7", 6'8", guy, comes off of the bench and hits David Brown
right.
at the University of Tulsa in the back of the head.
The wrong guy to hit.
Wrong guy to hit, but plants him right there. And anyway, Tulsa goes on and wins this ball game. And now let me tell you a little something that you may or may not know. I may have told you this story before. Our next ball game, we travel, as I recall, to Creighton.
OU.
Okay.
I can edit that.
All right.
We don't play Creighton until down here. We get stuck with it. We're on a winning streak.
Okay.
Until we get down here. We lose.
Okay,
to
well, let me tell you the story.
I'll edit that.
Okay.
While we're at a break, let me just to be sure. Okay.
Now, later on, January 3rd, we're playing at Creighton, Omaha, Nebraska.
Conference game.
Same time, Louisville is playing at Kansas State. All right?
Okay.
Now, remember, we've played this game a month or so earlier, and Wiley Brown is hitting David Brown and late in the game. And so we have a little commuter flight back from Creighton the day after the game to Kansas City to change planes to get back to Tulsa. Louisville, coming back from Kansas State, has a layover in the same airport in Kansas City to get back to Louisville. But we're sitting there eating breakfast, Nolan and I, and I look around, and here is Louisville coming into this air terminal.
Mm-hmm.
And I know David Brown does not have a short memory. And so I turned to Nolan, and he said, "We got to go find him." You know, so we take off. Well, we find a gift shop, and sure enough, as fate would have it, Wiley Brown of Louisville's in this little gift shop looking around, and David Brown sees him in there. Well, here's Nolan and I in there. Nolan, when he tells the story, we're setting picks. You know, we're trying to keep these two people apart.
Yes.
I mean, 268 guys having a big fight in a Kansas City airport isn't going to help either one of these programs, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, anyway, you know, here I am, this little white guy that comes about to David's belt buckle. And so far, Wiley has not seen David. Wiley pays for whatever it was he bought, starts out the door, and David hollers at him. Well, I just threw my arms around him, you know, to do what I could do. And Nolan tells Wiley to, you know, move on back to his team, you know. And he takes David. That's a circular airport up there.
Mm-hmm.
He takes him around the circle or out of my hearing. And they're gone for about 15 minutes. And when they come by, the first thing before he leaves, he said, "David," he said, "you want to be right back in that gutter that you have climbed out of. You know, mm-hmm. you don't want that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're bigger than that." So he takes him around the corner. About 15 minutes, they come back, and David's been crying. And the first thing Nolan has him do is come and apologize to me. Well, he'd have told me any apology.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just the way Nolan worked. But I think that story says more about Nolan and his kids than any that I could tell you. The only other that, you know, reminds me of the kind of kids they were. After beating Louisville, we go to the University of Oklahoma. Take a bus down there.
Right.
Okay.
Play Billy Tubbs.
Pay Billy Tubbs and beat Billy Tubbs in Oklahoma at the University of Oklahoma.
Right.
Okay. Well, to me, that's a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
To most TU fans.
Yes.
That's a pretty big deal. Well, what they do when you go on a bus like that, the trainer always finds some place where there's some fast food or something that when the game's over, they shove it onto the bus.
Boxes of chicken,
the guys can have something to eat as we start on our trip home. So we get on the bus, and they stop at this fast food place, and they shovel the chicken on, and I think, boy, what a celebration it is going to be all the way back down that turnpike to Tulsa, because TU has beaten the University of Oklahoma.
Uh-huh.
Well, it's quiet. I think, well, okay, they're eating. You know, these guys are starved. They've put out all this tremendous amount of energy. By the time, you know, when they finish eating, that's when the celebration will start. Because I've been on buses before,
yes.
You know, where you celebrate, you know. And so we get to the turnpike gate to turn east toward Tulsa. About the time I think we're going to be shouting and jumping and high-fiving, and they're all asleep.
Hmm.
They're all asleep. And I finally figured out you and I thought that was a big deal to beat the University of Oklahoma. Remember, several of these guys had come off of a 37-0 team that had won the Junior College National Championship the year before. These guys expected to win. They expected to win. There was no big surprise. It was a workmanlike game for them. And again, I go back to Nolan Richardson. He imbued them with that kind of confidence.
Yes. Well, you're so involved with the team. Didn't you give every player a nickname? On the squad?
Yeah, you kind of do. You know,
Al Jerkins.
came up with Rubber Band Man.
He did
for
a piece.
Paul Pressey.
He did a piece on him called The Rubber Band Man, which is a classic.
Yes.
And but you know, you just I don't think I ever purposely did that, but I did it because things I would hear in practice and things that they would remind me of as they went down the court, things I learned about them as people, mm-hmm. you know, in private.
Well, Mike Anderson, a short basketball player for mm-hmm. those guys, and you nicknamed him Mighty Mike.
Yeah.
And he would take a charge,
he'd
wind up on the third row of the bleachers to take a charge for the squad.
Right.
And Phil Spradling, he kind of had long hair at that time, and he'd run down the court fast, and you named him Roadrunner, and that stuck.
Yeah, he was, and big old Greg, you know.
Yeah, Greg Stewart.
Big old Greg, I got such a kick out of him because he was such a talent. Strange thing about him, he could not play his best without David Brown on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And when David got the bad knee later in his career, it really showed up in Greg as much as it did David.
Well, that was a special group of kids. That was two years that Nolan was here.
They really were. Paul Pressey, I still talk to Paul from time to time. You know, and people sometimes don't understand me quite when I say this. Paul Pressey meant the same thing to the TU basketball program that Larry Bird meant to Indiana State.
Mm-hmm.
In that, he made everybody else better. That was the great thing about Paul Pressey.
Yeah.
He made everybody else better.
Well, back in those days with Nolan, there was that intense rivalry with Wichita State. They were good.
They've got guys still playing in the pros.
Yeah, they were good. But one game I went on as a statistician for you, I think it was just to get a free ticket to the game, when we went up to Wichita, and it's February of 81, and Tulsa won a double overtime game in the roundhouse there at Wichita. And if you haven't been to a basketball game in Wichita, winning any type of game in that arena was great. Of course, they had the crazy coaches, and they had the fans, and they had some darn good players.
They had great athletes.
And I remember, Jerry, I was sitting by you. Paul Pressey was at the free throw line, and he struggled from there. He wasn't a great free throw shooter, probably shot 60%.
Right.
And he was fouled late in the game, and I was sitting next to you doing the stats, and he had a 1-1. The score was tied. He shot one that just barely rolled in. It barely rolled in, and the other one went up and seemed to hang on the rim.
Yeah.
And you elbowed me in the stomach. You elbowed me in the stomach. He made it!
Yes,
you know, you were broadcasting the game. I was doing that. You elbowed me in the stomach, and the game was over, and the fans started throwing paper wads at us. You know, that was exciting.
It really was. And that night, when we got on the bus, is the first time in that entire year, there were some big victories that this team was affected. Who was that? It may have been Bruce Vanley, who got on the bus with a boom box. And on the boom box was playing Celebrate.
Yes.
And for the first time,
mm-hmm.
those guys did Celebrate.
Yeah.
That win meant something to them in that setting. And for 5 or 10 or 15 minutes, you know, they clapped and had a good time,
mm-hmm.
like I thought they were going to do after the OU game.
Those are some great years. And the trip to New York for the NIT, that was just amazing, being a TU fan for years. And here we go, get to go to New York. And I remember this. I'm going to tell a little story on you. We went to, no, this was at San Diego. When we went to San Diego at the Cabrillo Classic in 82, we played Raleigh Massimino and things. I carried all my luggage on a carry-all. You remember joking with me, teasing me, because I carried all my luggage on and was lugging this big piece of luggage? Tell them what happened to your luggage, Jerry.
I'm not sure where it wound up.
You lost it. I think it wound up in Albuquerque or something.
I think it did.
And you remember, you had to go to the store in the hotel to buy a clean shirt. You were complaining it was a...
back then, like $25 for a clean shirt. And I remember just sitting laughing at you.
But that was a great setting.
Yeah,
you know,
it was.
The Cabrillo Classic was a great setting. We stayed at a historic old hotel.
Yeah, where they made some movies.
Made a lot of movies and Kings and this and that stay.
Another thing about the trip in 81 to New York City, where did we go for a side trip? Do you remember
where we went? Yankee Stadium.
Remember we went to Yankee Stadium?
We went to Yankee Stadium.
Do you remember how we got there?
Yes, I remember that we went on, I thought we were going to not get there.
Well.
Subway.
You remember there was four or five of us.
Right.
We were going to go to Yankee Stadium to get a tour. And we weren't, you know, here we are from Claremore and Coss City and Berry Hill trying to find our way in New York City. And we ran toward a train late that was going to take us to Yankee Stadium. And it was like one of those movies. The train started pulling out, and the doors started going in, and we all got on except this last trainer, this one little young trainer. And he leaped in, grabbed hold of the pole, and his foot came down on this very large person that
was a native of New York.
Right. And so you can guess where we were going. And this guy, remember the words that came out of his mouth? We didn't hear in Sunday school.
No.
And we looked around, and there were only people from the New York area in there with us. And we had stuff on it that said Tulsa Golden Hurricane. Oh. It might as well said Hicks from the Sticks. And the announcer on the train said, next stop, Harlem. And we start to sweat. And then tell him, what do you do? You remember what you did to the man that was cussing?
I remember talking to him. And
you turned around and started talking to him about the weather. And he looked at you like you were from Mars.
Yes.
And he got
I don't know what else to do.
And he got off on the next stop.
And I was scared to death.
And we were just, oh no, I could see it now, you know, Hicks killed on subway station.
But it turned out all to be worth it when we get to Yankee Stadium, where I'd never been in my life.
Yes.
You know, and we get to see the monuments and We got to see Steinbrenner's office.
We went to Steinbrenner's office, and they showed us around all through Yankee Stadium. We got to go to the clubhouse, and remember we called people at home on the phone from the Yankee Stadium dugout. We were calling our friends up.
It was a great trip, but you know the end of that trip, coming in that March morning.
Right, we had won the NIT, had won it in overtime. We didn't stay all night. We just got on a plane after the game was over.
And it was late because Nolan had the press conference,
right,
and you got the ceremony with the presentation. Right.
So it was 4:30 in the morning when we land out at Tulsa International Airport.
And it's cold. And we get on final approach, and the pilot comes on, and he says, I am told that there are some people waiting for you all here. Now, this is 4:30 in the morning, as you know.
We thought maybe the wives or the girlfriends.
Well, yeah, or maybe a fraternity, you know, still had part of a six-pack left or something, you know. But we roll up to that baggage area where the charters come in and look out across there. They open the door and look out across there. And all of these hundreds of homemade signs and all of these people. And we get on that old white activity bus, you know, TU used to
have. I think it's still out there.
and go rolling through them. And I, after all of the thrills, the goosebumps just were incredible. And, of course, that carried over into the next day at Bartlett Square.
Remember the Bartlett Square? And there was, 20,000 people down there at Bartlett Square?
Turned this town on its ear like it never has been.
Right. Those were some great days.
The best.
Yeah.
The very best.
Well, let's go now. You continue to do sports. The scene in Tulsa begins to stabilize somewhat. They have success at University of Tulsa in football and basketball with John Cooper and Don Morton, and J.D. Barnett comes in and has a couple of good years to start off with. Oklahoma's still winning championships. Oklahoma State becomes a power in college football. It seems like the Drillers are turning around. Now that franchise seems stable. Mm-hmm. A young kid from Ohio, Joe Pressman, comes in and works magic here with baseball. And then in 1986, you make a switch.
Right.
You leave something that is very, really dear to your heart, and you love it, to go to news.
Well,
what happened?
I left something that had become too easy also. you know, when you get to a certain age, Wayne, you got to be challenged, because if you're not challenged, you don't do your best work. Now, I could be challenged at the OU Texas game, but that's once a year.
Yes.
Or, you know, but also remember this. My very close friends have gone. Nolan Richardson has gone to the University of Arkansas. I miss him.
Yes.
John Cooper has gone to Arizona State on his way to Ohio State. I miss him. Not that the new fellows, I enjoy Don Morton and all those guys.
Right, you continue to do their show.
Oh, yeah. But there was a relationship that I had really become dependent upon, you know, with Nolan and John and people like that. And then there was this challenge of, in news, you can make a bigger impact, you know, on your community, on your station, on ratings. And we're talking about ratings, you know.
In the broadcast business, that's what makes
that's
the
what
world go
about.
Around. That's right.
And so we decided to go that direction. And I didn't regret it. If I couldn't have watched sports anymore, I would have regretted it, you know. But I'm as big a sports fan today as I was the last day I did sports. I just have to do it in a quieter way and not try to influence somebody's opinion whose responsibility it is to cover sports, you know.
Now, you never influenced anybody here on the St. Louis Cardinals?
Oh, I've tried. But, you know, Al's a Yankee fan.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the people that have worked for you and that you've hired. Ron Franklin, he's now a nationwide broadcaster, left here and went to Houston.
Right. Ron was here when I came here. Ron is an Ole Miss grad and is one of the finest gentlemen that there ever has been. Worked in Houston for years. I think he has his own production company now that does a lot of the University of Texas coaching shows and this and that. And he does a lot of stuff for ESPN, naturally. He's just a classy guy, and I'm so proud of Al Jerkins. You know, he came to work during my period of time
because
he's so talented.
If anybody could take a Yankee and make him, you know, make him where you could get along with him, you did.
Well, let me tell you, the great thing about Al, here's what people need to understand about Al. Nobody can outwork Al. Al will outwork you. Now, I respect that. I mean, I learned that from my daddy a long time ago. You know, they may be bigger and stronger and prettier, but they can't outwork you. And Al has that philosophy. Boy, when he was working for me, if I worked all night on a coach's show, Al worked all night. I didn't have to ask him.
Yes.
I mean, that's Al. Mm-hmm. That's the way he is. So I really love and admire his work, and he's creative. He's extremely creative. And then, you know.
Well, you allowed him, back in the early 80s, one of the first times ever I remember seeing feature sports reporting.
Yeah.
That was Al. You could see his talent come through on the report on Paul Pressey. If anybody saw that report on Paul Pressey, the rubber band man, you're going to remember that.
And it's as fresh today as
forever.
When he did it.
That's right. And the stories you did, not necessarily you were one of the first people I remember seeing covering girls' sports, not just reporting the scores, but talking about the girl and what she had to go through to play sports in high school and college. And you covered...
We did pioneer a lot of that.
Right.
And I'm proud of that because high schools were good to me, and I thought they were very much overlooked when I became sports director here. So we did a lot with the high schools. But, you know, Jeff Metters is one of mine.
ESPN,
extremely... Right. Talented, you know, sky's the limit for him.
Dick Pryor?
Dick Pryor, who hosts OETA's news in the evening, worked for me. Todd Whitthorn, he's a lot like Al in how hard he works. You know, if I said, and I've even forgotten the quarterback's name down in Mississippi that everybody's recruiting at OU eventually got, and he turned out to be a bust, but... He'd get in the car, he and a photographer, they'd drive to Mississippi, and I mean, it didn't bother him.
Yeah.
You know, and it didn't bother me to ask him, it didn't bother him to do it.
Right.
That's good, that's the reason those people become successful. Right.
Then you also worked, actually not in sports here at Channel 2. He was in the news department, but he was your sidekick on the radio broadcast. Was Bob Stevens,
oh, yeah.
who's now with ESPN.
And doing a very, very good work. And then I had two guys, see, that TU fans all know, Neil Jones and Mike Davis.
Yes.
Because you talk about guys who had talent and worked hard, but remained anonymous. Because all of those coaches shows we were doing live, and when we were doing the football coaches live, you're turning them around the next morning at 11 o'clock.
Well, the game is over at 10:30.
Well, we may be playing at Florida State.
Right, and you still have to have the game on the next morning.
You still got to have the live show. And so Neil and Mike shot and edited, you know.
All night.
I'd go all night long. I'd go through and mark highlights and then I would ad-lib the show, you know, just the coach and I would ad-lib it, which gave it its spontaneity anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But they're immensely talented. Neil's in Kansas City now doing very well.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike's at TCI Cable still doing the coach's show for TU and doing extremely well.
Mm-hmm. You go to news in 1986 and you mm-hmm. remain through news to 1997. And one of the best features I've ever seen is the Positively Oklahoma series
right.
that you had for years, where you didn't go out and interview the governor, you didn't go out and interview
no.
the mayor or a superstar athlete. You went around to interview the people, really, I think, that most people identify with. You interviewed a farmer. You would interview a lady that ran a bakery and got up
right.
at 3 o'clock in the morning. And you would make an interesting and detailed story out of the common folk.
Well,
did you have that in the back of your mind all these years?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I'm a native Oklahoman. You know, the president or the governor or the legislature make laws and this and that, but this state runs, America runs, on the common man and woman who get up every day and take care of the responsibilities. And I admire them so greatly because my father was that kind of man. My mother is that kind of woman. And we take them for granted. They take themselves for granted a lot of times. They've got these marvelous skills that they just take for granted, but people identify with them. And I knew they would.
Mm-hmm.
And so, no. That's been the most mm-hmm. gratifying thing I've done.
And then now you've changed it up just a little bit now that you have gotten off the nightly news desk and produced the feature, the Heartland series, which
yeah.
which again is a little bit different version of
it's expanded,
Positively
really.
Oklahoma, but 5 minutes every night. Now, a lot of people will, where's Jerry? I don't see him on every night, but 5 minutes, what's he doing all day long? What's the average time, Jerry, it takes till the time you get an idea for a story? By the time you secure the interview, travel to the interview, interview the person, do some research, edit the show, record the show, how many hours does it take to do one of those five-minute shows?
Well, it takes a long time. And the travel is the thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can... What we wind up doing is when you get in a time bind, you try to do more of them closer to town and maybe get two in the can in one day because... My preference is to travel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's great stories down the Kiamish. There's great stories in Tahlequah. But when you start figuring in your travel time and this and that, and the writing time and the editing time, you can get yourself in a bind. And we have to have one of those every day, 5 days a week,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so it just takes a little planning. It
yeah.
takes a little planning.
Well, before I let you go, Jerry, I want to talk about... How many high school sports banquets have you hosted? How many end-of-the-year University of Tulsa athletic programs have you hosted? And then tell me what your total fee has been that you've made over these hundreds of times going around speaking to schools.
Well,
I'll tell you, you've charged nothing.
Well, it's true.
You have never charged anything.
And I don't know how many I've done, but I tell you, it's a labor of love. It really has been. Here's the thing about it, Wayne, that there are, when you talk about education, when you talk about high schools and colleges, and when you talk about religion, you're talking about two entities that don't have a lot of money to spread around. I'm willing to give my time for those. Now, if there's some big corporation that wants me to talk to them and they've got some extra money that they want to pay, that's all right. Mm-hmm. You know, I may or may not do it. But I am available to education and religious institutions mm-hmm. for zero. You know, if my health is good and yeah. if... because we have to have those. I mean, if we don't have education, if we don't have a place to worship, we don't have anything.
Right.
And if all it takes, all it requires of old Jerry Weber is to say, get up in front of people and talk, I can do
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
I can do that.
Well, most of the people I'm sure know that you've announced here recently. Let me go back. Let's go back to September of this year. The University of Tulsa and the governor of Oklahoma honor you at halftime of one of the biggest games they've ever had at Skelly Stadium, the Tulsa-Oklahoma State game in September of 98. What was it like to walk out on that field, not as a reporter, not, you know, looking for the guy that recovered the fumble? What was it like when you walked out on the field and those people in the stands stood up?
Well, it was overwhelming. I'm glad I didn't have to make a speech, Wayne, because I could not.
For once, you couldn't.
No, it was just so overwhelming, and this huge contingent of TU fans right in front of me got up and just took my breath away. You know, this is after the governor had made the presentation. And first of all, that's a special place to me out there.
Mm-hmm.
I spent so many happy hours out there. And President Lawless and his wife, you know, were so generous to us also. And to have my family with me
yes.
out there, my wife, my children, and their children, you know, I had grandchildren with me out there. I've never had a more signal honor in my life. And I thank everybody involved, you know, the governor, the university, and all the great fans. But you're right, when those fans rose up and started waving that hurricane flag. And,
yeah.
I saw Cleveland's husband.
Don Kerberger.
Don yes. Kerberger up there waving, and I almost lost it. I thought, Don, let me get off of this field, you know, with a dry eye if I possibly can. But it was special.
One more thing. Of course, many people know that you've been diagnosed with a form of cancer,
mm-hmm.
and you are treating it, still working most
right.
of the time, and doing fine. But I want people to know that the man Jerry Weber is more than sports and having a good time and reporting on television and being seen with the governor or Barry Switzer or somebody. Tell me about your faith, Jerry. You haven't been ashamed to share it.
No.
You haven't been a person that maybe points a finger in somebody's face, but you'll share your relationship with Christ. Tell me how that has helped you through the years and then at this point in your life.
Wayne, I've often said I'd be afraid to get up in the morning if I didn't know there were a God. You know, I would be afraid to get up in the morning. I'd be by myself. And I couldn't handle that. I'd be scared to death. And so, you know, my faith goes back to when I was a tiny child, when I had good parents and who took me to church with them. And so when this thing came about, the thing that sustained me the most is my religious faith, because I know it's serious. It's mm-hmm. as serious as it can get, you know. But I don't dwell on that, because I dwell on what the Lord can do for me. If He chooses to, if He doesn't, I have lived a wonderful life.
Mm-hmm.
I have no regrets about anything. And so somebody asked me the other day, said, boy, you must, the tough times must be late at night, you know, when you're trying to go to sleep and thinking about, no, That's not true. I mean, that's where my faith sustains me. Mm-hmm. You know, I sleep good and get up the next morning ready to go again, because I don't plan on rolling over and just, you know, accepting whatever comes my way. I intend to pray and fight and fight and pray until I win this thing.
Mm-hmm. One way or the other, you will win.
Absolutely.
Great.